It's the NPR News Update for Wednesday, October 22nd. Good day. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News on your schedule. On today's podcast, how healthcare reform is playing out in the Minnesota Senate race. We'll hear about minor party candidates in the governor's race. We hear about high-profile trade secret issues in the Twin Cities. EMTs prepare for Ebola, and where have all the wheelchairs gone? First, Michelle Obama headlined a get-out-the-vote rally for DFLers yesterday in Minneapolis. Matt Sepik reports.
After campaigning for a Senate candidate in Iowa, Mrs. Obama stopped at Patrick Henry High School in North Minneapolis to stump for Governor Mark Dayton and U.S. Senator Al Franken. Both are enjoying leads in the polls. However, the First Lady said Democrats should not be complacent.
When the midterms came along, too many of our people just tuned out. And that's what folks on the other side are counting on this year, because they know that when we stay home, they win.
A KSTP Survey USA poll has Franken running 15 points ahead of Republican Mike McFadden. Another poll from the same group shows Dayton with a 10-point edge over GOP challenger Jeff Johnson. In a statement, Johnson says Democrats are bringing in the, quote, big guns because the party is concerned about Dayton's ability to articulate his own message. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
Republican Senate candidate Mike McFadden has been calling for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act since he launched his campaign against DFL Senator Al Franken more than a year ago. McFadden says states should come up with their own plans to increase access to health care. But experts say much of what McFadden is proposing to replace Obamacare has been tried before and left millions of Americans without health insurance. Mark Zedeklik reports.
Mike McFadden takes advantage of every opportunity to slam the Affordable Care Act as he seeks support from voters.
I guarantee you that Obamacare is the wrong answer. It is a train wreck, and that's quoting a Democrat, Senator Max Baucus.
McFadden uses that Baucus quote a lot, but he takes a former Democratic senator from Montana out of context. Baucus did not say Obamacare was a train wreck. He did say in a Senate hearing prior to the federal exchange going live that he saw a huge train wreck coming down. He was referring to what turned out to be the disastrous rollout of the insurance exchange, not the law itself. As for McFadden's plan for replacing that law, he says rather than relying on a one-size-fits-all federal solution, states should be allowed to come up with their own plans.
When I say that states are laboratories for experiment, I mean, I want them to experiment. I just think it's you run into a fundamental problem with a program that's this large.
McFadden would leave most of the decisions up to states, including whether to require people to buy health insurance. But he would force states to keep some of the most popular benefits of Obamacare. Their plans would be prohibited from placing lifetime caps on insurance payouts, and they'd have to allow parents to keep adult children on their insurance up to age 26. In addition, under McFadden's plan, the federal government would give the states $15 billion to subsidize high-risk pools. McFadden says those pools would provide health insurance to people with pre-existing conditions for the same price healthy people pay.
What I can tell you fundamentally is it's going to cost less by decentralizing it and allowing states to do it as opposed to the federal government. I believe that strongly.
McFadden would also allow small businesses to pool buying power to get reduced insurance rates. And he says insurance companies should be allowed to compete across state lines. He says that would improve health care and bring down prices.
If you look at his plan, it doesn't add up.
Al Franken contends it's not possible to keep the popular parts of the Affordable Care Act without also keeping the mandate that people buy insurance. He says it's common sense.
If you can't be denied because you have a pre-existing condition, why get insurance unless you're sick? Why pay for it? So no free riders. That's what the mandate is.
MIT health economist John Gruber helped write the Massachusetts health care plan Republican Governor Mitt Romney enacted in 2006. RomneyCare included an insurance mandate. It became the model for the Affordable Care Act. Gruber says you cannot pay for benefits McFadden wants to offer without requiring everyone to buy into the insurance pool.
You can't fix the problems of the insurance market without a mandate. And that's not just a theoretical conjecture. We've seen it. A number of states tried what this guy is suggesting in the 1990s. They tried putting all those insurance regulations in, without a mandate, and they blew up their insurance markets.
As for McFadden's contention that cross-border competition should be part of the healthcare solution, Sabrina Corlett of Georgetown University's Center on Health Insurance Reforms says past regional attempts to spur sales across state lines were not successful.
What we found was that prices didn't go down. There were no new insurance companies selling to consumers or small businesses. They were really sort of ineffective.
So too, Corlett says, were government-subsidized high-risk pools like the ones McFadden is calling for.
The coverage is just extremely expensive, and many people found it unaffordable and went untreated.
Most polls show a thin majority opposes the Affordable Care Act. Still, Franken says he's convinced he can successfully campaign as a supporter of the law and provisions that even McFadden would not do away with.
I believe that I'm on the right side of this, and I think that Minnesotans agree with me.
Franken will know in less than 2 weeks. Mark Zedeklik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The three major party candidates for governor, DFL Governor Mark Dayton, Republican Jeff Johnson, and Independence Party candidate Hannah Nicolette, have been getting lots of attention this campaign season. But there are two other candidates on the ballot you may not be familiar with. Tom Scheck has an introduction.
While Democrats and Republicans would be dissatisfied being well behind in the polls, grassroots legalized cannabis party candidate Chris Wright is happy to be considered at all.
We just showed up in the KSTP USA poll. It's like, I'm polling. I got 1%. We're winning.
Wright was fourth in that recent poll, but he feels he has a winning issue.
My main priority is to legalize marijuana.
Wright also supports reducing greenhouse gas emissions, a constitutional amendment that says human beings, not corporations, are entitled to constitutional rights and a single-payer government-run healthcare system. But there's no doubting his top priority, legalizing marijuana.
It affects crime and punishment. It affects civil rights. It affects farm issues. Just regular freedom.
Wright is 57 years old. He lives in Edina and owns a computer shop in Bloomington. In his back office, posters documenting marijuana rallies from the 1980s and 1990s hang on the walls. In 2010, 7,500 people voted for Wright for governor. He also ran for governor in 1998 and for Congress in 1988, pushing for legalization.
When we started the grassroots party in 1986, virtually no one was out there for legalization. People would come up to us and at the state fair and things like that and say, well, you ought to be shot, you know, and it's like, wow, that's a little strange to hear from people, you know, but this was at the height of the Reagan drug war, you know.
Wright said he believes marijuana will soon be legalized. He said state policy leaders won't be able to ignore the tax revenue it generates. And while the major party candidates are prepping for election night victory speeches, Wright said his measure of victory is whether marijuana becomes legal.
It might take till the next election to know if I won, because maybe at that point they'll say, gosh, I need those votes, right? Took so many votes away from us.
Wright isn't the only candidate pushing for legal marijuana. Libertarian Chris Holbrook also supports it. Holbrook is the other minor party candidate on this year's ballot, and like Wright, he had to gather 2,000 signatures during a two-week filing period in May and June, and it was during that filing period that Holbrook drew the attention of Minneapolis Park Police.
What are you doing? I'm asking, what are you arresting him for? What is your cause?
I simply told him you can't advertise in the park.
In late May, a Minneapolis Park Police officer forcefully detained and arrested Holbrook for collecting signatures at Lake Calhoun. The head of the park police later apologized and waived Holbrook's citation, but cell phone video of the incident plays into Holbrook's campaign message.
I am sick of sitting back watching my rights taken from me, watching people's rights taken from them.
Holbrook says he wants to get government out of nearly every aspect of life. He wants to eliminate the corporate and personal income taxes and replace them with a flat sales tax. He also doesn't think abortion, same-sex marriage, and other social issues are the government's business.
I'm sick of the government telling me I can't smoke marijuana if I want to. I can't buy fireworks if I want to. I can't buy beer on Sundays if I want to. I'm sick of those things. I'm sick of the government taking my money, taking my income that I worked very hard for and giving it to other people.
The St. Paul resident says he also wants to cut government spending by 20% by eliminating subsidies for businesses and light rail transit and by ending public works projects like the Senate office building. And like Wright, Holbrook doesn't have many illusions that he will one day reside in the governor's mansion.
I mean, it's a 99.99% chance we won't win. But as a coach of the Buccaneers said years ago, we're only 2 to 3 heart attacks away from being in the playoffs. So anything's possible.
Holbrook said his main goal this year is to grow the Libertarian Party in Minnesota. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Two men have pleaded guilty in Hennepin County District Court to separate murders this summer in Minneapolis. Peter Cox reports.
The Hennepin County Attorney's Office spokesman says 26-year-old Quanin Mahacek pleaded guilty to first-degree murder and was immediately sentenced to life without parole in the stabbing death of 25-year-old Cody Raish. Prosecutors say Mahacek admitted in court he was looking for someone to kill on September 10th. He saw Raish walk past with his girlfriend at Little Earth Community in Minneapolis. The men fought, and Mahacek pulled out a knife and stabbed Raish several times in the neck. In a separate case, 17-year-old Joshua Ford pleaded guilty to second-degree murder for shooting and killing 38-year-old Andrew Billingsley Jr. on July 24th. Prosecutors say the two got into an argument on a Metro Transit bus, and Ford pulled out a gun and told Billingsley to get off the bus. Billingsley got off, and Ford ran out the back door. He chased and shot Billingsley several times. Prosecutors say Ford is expected to be sentenced to 400 months in prison. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Hennepin County Attorney's Office charged a 29-year-old St. Paul woman with murder yesterday for the weekend shooting of another woman at a downtown Minneapolis strip club. Brant Williams reports.
According to the criminal complaint, Jasmine Nicole Jones and a woman later identified by the medical examiner's office as 32-year-old Lakeisha Marie Neal argued at Augie's nightclub. Prosecutors say as the women moved toward the back of the club, surveillance video recorded what looks to be a muzzle flash and Jones holding an object that appears to be a gun. The complaint says Jones turned herself in and turned in a 9mm handgun. Prosecutors say the gun is undergoing forensic tests. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The Minnesota business community has seen two recent lawsuits related to the alleged theft of trade secrets, one at the Mayo Clinic and another at Boston Scientific. According to an article in the current issue of The Atlantic, the number of lawsuits over non-compete agreements and trade secrets has nearly tripled since the year 2000. Steve and John talked about trade secrets with Aaron Hall. He's a managing partner of the Thompson Hall Law Firm in Minneapolis.
What kinds of secrets are we talking about here?
One big example is the Kentucky Fried Chicken secret recipe. Now, if you got a patent on that, a patent would expire typically just over 20 years. Mm-hmm. That's why a lot of pharmaceutical drugs don't have very long of a life before they go generic. But you can keep it protected forever under trade secret law. But that means you must take reasonable efforts to keep that recipe secret. It might be the recipe to Coke. It could be a business process or formula. It could be a database or software code. The key is, though, you have to keep it secret. And if you register it for copyright protection or patent protection, you are disclosing it to the public, so you cannot do both. You must pick one or the other.
Now, it used to be that an employee would spend his or her entire career with one company, and as that culture has changed, are we seeing more of these trade secret and intellectual property issues arise?
Probably. It's probably the fact that the workforce is more transient and switching more often. That probably contributes to it. Second, I think you're seeing that companies are using lawsuits as a business strategy because they know so few lawsuits will actually go to trial, but they can tie up and distract their competitors with litigation. So even though they know they may not win, if they have a good faith basis, it's not a frivolous suit, but there's a good faith basis to make an argument, they can really distract a competitor and tie up a key employee who left the company and now is working with a competitor. So I think you have that business strategy there. And while the justice system has an interest in preventing the use of the courts in that way, let's admit it, it does happen.
Aaron Hall, it would seem to me that there's got to be a large gray area between what an employee gains in institutional knowledge over time and what would be considered a company's protected information. Am I right?
You are right. And in fact, the company needs to show that it's not just information or education that the employee had, but it was actually declared as a trade secret and confidential. And even when the company declares that it's confidential, it doesn't mean that it constitutes a trade secret. There can be information. It may be always confidential. It was always kept that way. It was always marked that way. But a court can say, no, that's common. That's simply knowledge or decisions or insights. It does not rise to the level where it acquires trade secret protection. But you're right. It is a gray area. The best cases are the ones where it's a formula to Coca-Cola or KFC chicken. It's going to be much grayer in a client list or just internal documents in a company, for example, forms. By the way, too, the courts are often going to look at what is the weight of the equity here. In other words, if something just smacks as unfair and it just seems like, come on, that's common sense, you shouldn't do that, that probably is a trade secret, and the court may hang its hat on the trade secret argument, whereas you might have a lot of little infractions, and the court may say, you know what, on their own, these are such little things, they do not rise to the level of trade secret protection. So in other words, the courts are given discretion, and I do think a lot of times judges are using common sense to say, did somebody really do something wrong here? And if so, we may tie that to trade secret. And if not, we're not going to find that there is a trade secret.
All right. Well, this has been an informative discussion. Thanks.
Thank you.
That's Aaron Hall, CEO and managing partner of Thompson Hall Law Firm in Minneapolis, talking about trade secrets and copyrights and protected information.
Aaron Hall and Stephen John last night on All Things Considered. There's a lot of focus right now on the hospitals that are handling the Ebola cases reported in the U.S., but the front line of the battle against the disease might well be a fire station. Tim Nelson has more.
When Thomas Eric Duncan grew gravely ill with Ebola symptoms in Texas last month, it wasn't doctors or nurses who treated him first. It was three paramedics from Dallas Fire Rescue Station 37. Luckily, none of them got sick. But a similar situation could play out here in Minnesota, where ambulances like this one are dispatched daily from places like Station 6 on St. Paul's west side. And that may well be what Minnesota's initial Ebola case, if there is one, might sound like at first. It might be a routine 911 call to check on a sick person, and instead of a nurse in a biohazard suit, it could be a paramedic crew that goes to help, probably wearing their regular uniform.
I think that is absolutely something that looms large in everybody's mind.
Matt Simpson is St. Paul's Deputy Chief of Emergency Medical Services, and he says it isn't just Ebola that prompts concern. Simpson says paramedics face serious biological hazards every day. They include bacterial meningitis, HIV, tuberculosis, and Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, just to name a few. Vigilance and preparation are nothing new, he says.
We have so many different bugs, if you will, out there that we just have to be aware of.
And no one may know that better than the paramedics in St. Paul. One of them died 5 years ago after apparently being infected by a patient he was called to help. Ray Haynes' widow, Gail, says he made a medic run one day in 1996.
He was performing CPR on a person who, ended up dying from a heart attack, and when, he was kneeling in his body fluids, whatever it was, and he had some scabs on his knees, and so that was the point of entrance.
An infection in his leg sent Hain to the hospital, where doctors put him on IV antibiotics. 2 years later, Hain discovered the real toll. The infection had seriously damaged his heart, And despite a heart transplant, he died in 2009, leaving behind his wife and two daughters.
You know, they use the personal protective gear, so I felt like he would be covered, but it was just kind of one of those fluke things.
Paramedics say they're thinking about that as Ebola cases emerge in the U.S. Ebola is thought to be most dangerous in its end stages, but no one really knows how they might encounter it. Robert Ball is operations supervisor for Hennepin County Emergency Medical Services in Minneapolis.
Ebola is certainly something that we're following the Minnesota Department of Health and CDC guidelines to ensure that we're taking the proper precautions for our staff and our equipment.
Ball says his crews have added extra thick gowns to their supplies, and his agency could designate a special vehicle to take someone to the airport for a flight out of state for treatment. They've recently asked operators to ask questions about travel history when people call 911. But he says there's a limit to what emergency medical services can do. No one, for instance, wants to keep a suspected Ebola patient waiting in a doctor's office or a regular clinic while a special vehicle is dispatched from far away, not if a regular ambulance is nearby. Dave Page trains paramedics at Inver Hills Community College and says responders will likely have to meet this challenge like all the rest they see daily with what they have.
It's impractical for us to get out of ambulances every day in hazardous material suits with very expensive and very cumbersome equipment that would only panic people more, but frankly is most of the time not necessary.
And he says overreaction could also divert attention and care from other serious risks. Page thinks that whatever happens in coming days with Ebola, more Minnesotans will die this year of a different outbreak, the flu. Tim Nelson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
We close out the NPR News Update podcast by traveling to Rochester. If you go there, you're likely to see wheelchairs, specifically Mayo Clinic's blue wheelchairs. Rochester draws thousands of patients every day, and many of them use wheelchairs to get around the clinic. Not so surprising, right? It's where the wheelchairs end up that can be unusual. Elizabeth Baer explains one of the quirks about living in Minnesota's Med City.
Mayo wheelchairs ferry around thousands of patients. What got me wondering were all the empty wheelchairs sitting alone all over town. They're in parking ramps, on downtown sidewalks, at the supermarket. I saw one on a trail in a city park. So I set out to see how far the wheelchairs travel and whose job it is to bring them back. A few blocks from Mayo at the American Legion, I met Carol and Denny Scanlon. They're both in their 60s, both retired, both longtime Rochester residents. They come here a few times a week, and Denny says Mayo wheelchairs do too.
And I'll see them sitting there, and then 3 days later we stop down here again and they're gone. So he probably rides it over here and thinks, well, okay.
Now I can walk home?
A few seats away, Bob Fox chimes in with his own story. He spotted one this summer at a restaurant in Preston. That's 40 miles away.
I assume they just went down for lunch and come back, bring it back when they come back. They didn't steal it. They were just borrowing it.
Denny and Carol Scanlon say wheelchairs are just part of the Rochester landscape.
I never even thought of it till just now. Yeah. I thought, well, yeah, I see them kind of everywhere we go, I guess.
At the mall, in a restaurant, fine. We're so used to it that I don't even notice it.
But some people do notice the big blue chairs. A few blocks away, Shelly Joseph owns the Blue Water Salon. It's on the Skyway level of the DoubleTree Hotel. Joseph walks out of the salon and opens the door to a nearby stairwell.
So just literally, I see them. I don't know why they're in here, but randomly, they're in this stairwell.
Is this a public stairwell?
It's a fire exit, basically. So it can be, but I mean, mostly it's staff that uses it. So I don't know if they're just people are hiding them there for... I have no idea.
Across the hall, Dawn Lee Britt manages a Starbucks. She takes me to the employee entrance at the back of the coffee shop.
We see the wheelchairs being parked right behind our door that we go out for staff only, and sometimes we can't get out.
Lee Britt says this happens at least a couple times a week.
I'm getting used to it because we see them so often. They're just always around. I don't know why. It's like they don't need it anymore or it's time to go. I don't know.
It turns out Mayo has about 1,200 wheelchairs in Rochester's fleet at any given time. Ralph Marquez is the general services manager who oversees patient equipment. He says the clinic loses as many as 150 chairs each year.
Yes, it's a financial burden to us from that standpoint, but it's also a service we provide. And if the patient, you know, truly comes first, sometimes that's the expense of the business. You know, we have a beautiful campus. It's an open campus. We don't want to restrict our equipment from leaving the campus.
The clinic's courier service rounds them up weekly, mostly from hotels and many other places they're alerted to. But Marquez says the chairs can sometimes end up really far away.
We've gotten calls from Orlando Airport. Goodwill up in Duluth had one of our chairs, and luckily we were able to retrieve that one. We've had them in Denver, out east, in a few airports. They get back to us dirty and needed to be cleaned and things. That's our people may take them home for a while. They wind up everywhere.
Everywhere, including the Rochester Public Library. John Hunziger works at the library and says wheelchair sightings are just one unique aspect of living in a medical community.
You see people with oxygen tanks. You see people with, you know, face masks on. And then, of course, you see people wheeling around an IV and really don't think much of it. I'm sure if you aren't used to Rochester, seeing somebody going down the skyway, you know, pushing an IV on a rolling stand looks kind of weird, but it's just part of living in Rochester.
And yes, some days part of Hunziger's job is to let Mayo know there's a big blue chair to pick up in the lobby. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
That's the Wednesday news on your schedule. I'm Phil Picardi. I'll be back with the Thursday NPR News Update.